once he opens.
Okay. Today is February 23rd, 2017, 3 o'clock p.m., and we're going to open informational hearing on e-government. Mr. Wally Rogers. Sir, if you don't mind, because of the time constraint that we have, if you know, we allow you to go through your slide presentation, and if the committee will hold questions to the end, that'd be great. And you're on the clock.
Thank you, sir. My name is Wally Rogers. I'm the Oregon e-government manager for the state of Oregon, the state CIO's office. And e-government, I just wanted to orient you to what it is. Let me get up to the top here. We provide services for all agencies statewide. And I am here because of a question that came up around NIC-USA and the contract that's in place with NIC-USA. And it probably comes up in the hearings that NIC-USA is building this for us. But what those agencies should say is the Oregon e-government program and the state CIO's office is that's where we're getting our services from. And we have a master agreement with NIC-USA to do work orders against that for different agencies. So the scope of what we're doing, there's right now we have 152 websites we're doing for agencies. E-commerce, we process for them $5.1 billion over the biennium. 123 different online applications where there involves some level of programming. And a web application is different than a website. The web application is a different skill set. They actually have developers who work on making some interactivity. We have the open data portal for transparency and the online enterprise collaboration portal called GovSpace. So the e-government program, it's important to realize it started in 2001, Executive Order 125 established the program, and in that first iteration we staffed it, and then we had staff augmentation with a contract with Daniels Research. In 2005, we decided to bring in a full contract to help do the technology aspects of that. And I'm trying to show you that we've had multiple vendors in this role over time. In 2008, it was Hewlett-Packard who came in and ran that for us. We recompeted that. But before we went to the recompete, the legislature in its wisdom established House Bill 2146. It's a governance board. It oversees every our work orders. It sets priorities for them. It has the role of reviewing the terms of a contract as well. And so we reviewed the terms of the contract with NIC as part of the e-government program with that board, and were advised by them to proceed. And then in 2011, we've awarded the contract, and we transitioned in 2012 and have been running since 2012 with NIC as our latest iteration. So when we transitioned, we already had 200 services we were running with Hewlett-Packard, and now we're, as you saw, 293. So NIC has actually really helped us provide another level of support for our departments and agencies. Specifically on the master contract, it's a 10-year contract. We've completed the fourth year. All the data, and this was a specific question, is owned by the agency. It's in the master agreement. I have copies if anyone wants to look at it. The application source code, this is the knowledge that goes into the application to support the agency, is kept in escrow. And if the contract terminates, that's provided to the state. Each application complies with House Bill 2375. Each time a work order comes through for any agency, we do a DAS review, and we also do LFO review for legal sufficiency. And then it's sent over to be signed by the agency director. Each work order is executed against that master agreement under the oversight and prioritization of the Electronic Government Portal Advisory Board. And that had the Senate, the President of the Senate appoints two members, the Speaker of the House appoints two members, the Governor appoints three members, and two more of the public and a student. We also have the state CIO who appoints a representative and a member from DAS, and the state treasurer appoints a representative to that board. So we have a really good diverse oversight role that involves the legislature on every work order that's processed. So if you hear that NIC is working on a project, I want you to know it's really the CIO's e-government program that is working under the governance of the EPAB, and you actually our newest member to the Electronic Government Portal Advisory Board is right here, Representative Nierman.
Thank you. If I can, Mr. Chair. So I just want to say, in the interest of transparency, that I do serve on that board there. So, and that was after the NIC contract was entered into. So I didn't have any work on that. But I am a member of that board, and they do good work, and they have good leadership under Wally. So,
thank you, sir. These are the seven projects we currently have underway. We have between 7 or 11 actively being developed, the NIC team does, for our agencies. I think that was one of the questions you meant, what are we doing right now? We publish this. It's always on the EPAB site with the meeting documents. Also, we have what we call an opportunity report. These are all the departments that said, we might want to use your services. We're still doing our business case analysis. So we publish that, too, if we're interacting with an agency on that. The folks we do our work for and the NIC builds the systems for are winning awards. The electronic filing system that many are familiar with just received the State Scoop 50. It's voted on by your peers nationally from all 50 states. Our program itself, the IT program of the year, is the Oregon e-Government program, the same group. And then the National Association of State CIOs, another system that was deployed for Secretary of State, received a finalist award for the license directory rebuild. So any questions for me?
Any questions? Thank you, Wally, for your presentation and clarification. Representative?
So not really a question. I just would like to make a comment that I think that NICS does a very good job of doing that. And this is a very efficient and effective way to provide this kind of service, I think, is through this kind of government portal there. The amount of stuff that gets reused is huge, I think. And it's a good way of providing a balance between responsiveness to the agencies so that they get their needs met and they have a chance to be heard and get their projects bubbled up to the top in a timely manner. And on the other hand, not just throwing gobs of IT services that are expensive at agencies whenever they chirp or something and there's no thought or oversight given to are these effective in choices or anything like that, that there's actual real thought that goes into it. There's actual prioritization of projects that impact the most number of users and have the biggest impact on those users and just a grid that they go into. So it's an effective way to manage this kind of thing. So,
okay. Are there any other questions from the committee? No other question? Well, Co-Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Well, I'm not sure it's appropriate to ask the question. It's a private entity, private company.
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith, yes.
Do you feel comfortable sharing with us other states that you do work in?
I work for the state of Oregon. I'm a manager here. I'm not with the company.
Okay, right.
It is our program. I know they are in 26 other states. And we did our due diligence. So when we selected them, we had a panel of seven voting teams of 35 agency members when we did select them in 2011 for this contract.
And I apologize. I guess I knew you were with the state. And so when you were doing that due diligence, you found that the references checked out well.
Representative Smith, Co-Chair Representative Smith, yes, sir.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Not. All right. Thank you very much. We will close the information hearing on e-government programs, and we will now move to public hearing. We're doing public hearing on SB 5520, Oregon Government Ethics Commission, and we can have Ron Burnson, Dan Golden. How do you want to do this? Because there's four of you on the list here.
I think it's just the two of us.
Just two?
We'll be here this one.
And Robert, is that Otero? Thank you, sir. Okay, sir?
Good afternoon. co-chair Senator Manning and co-chair Representative Smith. I'm Dan Golden. I'm currently chair of the Oregon Governmental Ethics Commission. In my day job, I'm director of the Klamath County Juvenile Department in Klamath Falls, Oregon. So I have the privilege of a 500-mile round trip to come up to Salem and see you all today, and I'm honored to be here. The Oregon Governmental Ethics Commission has a mission of impartially and effectively administering and enforcing Oregon's government ethics laws for the benefit of Oregon's citizens. The commission emphasizes education in achieving its mission. The regulatory jurisdiction includes ORS Chapter 244, the Oregon Government Ethics Law, and chapters of ORS 171, the Lobbying Regulation Law, and executive session provisions of the Oregon Public Meetings Law found in ORS 192.660. I want to emphasize the voluntary nature of the commission itself. We have 9 members currently, and that's a bit of an increase from a few years ago. And these appointees from House and Senate majority and minority and the governor's office include folks who some practice law, others are educators and business people, and a few of us are public employees. And so we, you know, come from a diverse group, diverse background. We probably hear anywhere from 20 to 30 cases at each one of our meetings. We have meetings approximately every 5 to 6 weeks. Hear a variety of different matters from around the state of Oregon. I guess we want to get into some of the areas.
Sure.
So, sir, before you get started, I have some PowerPoint presentation. Did you want to have a PowerPoint presentation available?
Yeah, in fact, I thought that we had a few slides to show if we can get this picture of me off of the screen.
Camera adds 10 pounds.
Okay, all right.
While they're tuning up the machine there, I just want to also emphasize that most of the work done by the Ethics Commission is primarily preventative and educational in nature. We emphasize training for public officials. I think perhaps 200 public officials a month are trained by our staff. We have 2.4 FTE devoted to those trainings. And that's getting out and getting out in the, you know, all across Oregon and contacting folks in many different areas. So with that, Ron, what do you got?
Yes. Again, I really want to thank the co-chairs and the members of the committee for having us here today. I was talking with my wife, and this is my 9th presentation before Ways and Means as being an executive director. So, I've been around here like 16 years doing this and with the same committee. And so I appreciate the new members on there and the folks that I've seen before.
So for the record, sir, please state your name.
My name is Ron Burson. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Government Ethics Commission.
Thank you.
So, again, thank you very much for having us here today. So I will try to go through this presentation quickly. Sometimes what I'm talking about is not on the slides, but we will make it all work for you folks, and feel free to interrupt me at any time for any questions. So just to be clear, what the Ethics Commission does besides make our commissioners drive 500 miles to come see us is that we oversee, there's several programs with the agency, the first being, and probably the foremost program being, the education and training. The commission's really tried to do a large paradigm shift towards education, trying to get out in front of problems that people have had with the commission, trying to give advice out there, try to get people in-person training, and now, of course, online training that's out there, so that people are not violating the ethics laws and then finding out through the complaint process they violated the ethics laws, and somehow having some type of media exposure to that, training the rest of the folks in the area what not to do on the ethics laws, but trying to get out in front and answer those questions for folks. We also do investigations. Unfortunately, there are some folks that even once sometimes they know that there's that what they're not supposed to do, they still do that. So unfortunately, we still do need some investigators around, and we try to do a very thorough and complete investigation so we can come back to the commission. And we'll talk more specifically about these programs later on. There's the administration, which of course is just administering the agency, which I'm responsible for, and that's being conservative and being frugal with the funds that you folks are so generously give us to get our programs out there and make sure that we are responsible, because this agency is unique in the state of Oregon in that our funds are not only derived from the state of Oregon through an assessment, but also by local governments. So local governments actually pay half of the agency's budget. And so, obviously, in that payment, they're not looking for more of their public officials to have investigations. They want us to give them training and be available to them for advice out there. So just a real quick on those assessments. The way it works is the Secretary of State has a municipal audit fee. There's 8 different levels to that. I can't tell you what each level is, but I can tell you what the bottom and the top is. So a public body that has less than $50,000 in money that they expend is the lowest level, and $50 million and above is the highest level. And so to give you an idea, we assess at those levels for each one of the jurisdictions. So later on in this presentation, I will tell you what we predict the next biennium for these different jurisdictions to have to pay. So Chair Golden also talked about, we also oversee the lobby in the state of Oregon. They're required to register with us and file on a quarterly basis, and statements of economic interest that you folks that have been here before and had to file those, you're keenly aware of that. And I think Mr. Rogers had talked about that our electronic filing system, we launched it last year. And so this will be the second year for the system, and I know it's really helped the agency out, and I think it's really helped people be able to see those reports for us. So I don't know. I guess I need to.
Can I ask a question?
Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just one little question about the online filing system. Have you had any pushback from elected officials saying, I don't get online, I don't know how to work the internet or anything like that? Do you have any issues with that?
Chairs, Representative Nierman. Yes, we've had a few of those instances. I think the chair was going to talk about one of the jurisdictions we talked to recently, the Granite. Had said there, I think, were 63 people in town, and they were a little less than, online savvy, let's say.
In Granite? But, in Granite?
In Granite.
Oh, they had a baby.
I might be getting my numbers wrong, so don't hold me to the numbers. But I will say that the jurisdictions they work for, like the cities, have done really well with us in getting the folks to come down to City Hall and help fill them out. We as an agency have talked to those folks on the phone, trying to get them to file online, and we've been pretty successful at that. There's been a little bit of resistance, but for the most part, people have filed online. I think we gave out a few paper forms last year, but you have to remember, any paper form that comes into the agency, we as the agency then actually have to put it online for them. But I think you might have remembered, for the folks who have been around, this system was actually kind of instigated clear back in 2007, but through the rebalances and some problems, with funding of it, it didn't come up till we launched it in 2016. So even though that was a frustrating process over that time period, I think it actually benefited us in the long run, because between 2007 and 2016, I think a lot more people have access to a computer. In this system, you literally can file it on your phone if you want to. So, iPads, it doesn't necessarily take a desktop and a Wi-Fi to be able to do it. So it's, but we have seen just a little bit
and,
of that.
And yeah. Co-chairs and Representative Nierman, it is apparent that, as a society out there, I mean, there are a lot of different skill levels when it comes to doing any of this online submittal process. And the staff at the Ethics Commission office have been extremely helpful in fielding questions, you know, updating and helping people kind of get started and get through the process online, kind of walking folks through, you know, the whole new process. And I've been very grateful because I'm not the most computer savvy person in the world, and I needed a little help when, you know, we initially were doing SEIs and that kind of thing as well. So, you know, the staff is great at this, in this particular agency, at being very kind of customer oriented to the folks out there. Now, there have been occasional glitches, you know, as some of the systems have been tuned up, and we as a commission have been very forgiving in terms of, you know, basically saying, look, you know, let's just deal with this as an educational mission at this point, bringing people up to speed. We have not been going out there and playing gotcha, you know, with lobbyists or public officials who've struggled initially to, you know, get into the system and learn how to utilize it. So I'm confident at this point that this is, these electronic systems are things that are evolving. They're evolving in a positive way. It's going to add a whole lot of transparency to governmental functions around Oregon.
Good. Thank you.
More? No, that's
good. Thank you. Co-chairs. Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. Gentlemen, can you remind me and the committee, are the questions on the form, the electronic form, are those statutorily driven or are those created by the commission?
Chairs, co-chairs, Smith, those are actually statutorily driven. Yes, they're spelled out in Chapter 244.
Got it.
The questions are, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So anyway, moving forward, I think Chair Golden had talked a little bit about some changes in the commission. This is our new organizational chart, very large organization, as you can see. But when I started in 2006, there was three of us in there, so we feel pretty good about nine positions. But also, the commission itself has increased to nine positions, plus the makeup of the commission has actually changed due to the changes in 2015, the governor's bill in 2015, that only three members can be from any one party. So it used to be no more than, out of seven, no more than four could be from a party, but it changed to three. So we've actually brought on a couple of folks that are not affiliated with the Democrats or Republicans, and we have a new person coming up here, I believe, in the April one that will also be unaffiliated. So we will actually be up to what that called for, because it didn't call for us to lose anybody. Basically, when the replacements came about, they were going to be replaced with folks outside of the party. So by, I think, April 26th is when the next hearings are with the Senate rules, and we should have our 3-3 and 3. So anyway, we have two more positions in with the commission. So again, I talked just a little bit about this, how we get our revenue with the state. And I think it's important to point out, and if I could ask the committee, maybe I can ask LFO staff, was this given to the committee, the thing? Because I was going to talk just a little bit about that, and it's not in the presentation here.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, it's posted on OLIS with the materials for today's meeting.
Okay, thank you very much. So just real quickly, like I said, 50% of our funds come from the state of Oregon. 50% of our funds come from local governments. The local governments, the nice thing about that funding model is that there are over 1,700 jurisdictions that pay into the fund. And a number that I'm very proud of is that well over 99% of those folks actually comply with payment. So we do a good job of showing them the value for the money that they pay in to us. So, in fact, I think this last year was 99.637. So it's a very small amount that becomes delinquent each time. So having said that, local governments pay half. You can see down here at the what the fees will be for 2017-2019 biennium. So the smallest jurisdictions in that biennium will pay $83. The largest jurisdiction, and I always use the city of Portland because it's well over $50 million in expenditures, will pay $1,679 for the biennium. So by spreading it out, that many people, not one one group is getting actually charged a lot of money for our services. Now, having said that, just in complete disclosure, on this form that I had put into OLIS, it shows our record of assessment since it began in 2009 biennium. And in that 2009 biennium, we started out with $1.8 million of assessment. And in 2015-17, we had $1.6 million. But you'll notice in 2015-17, we actually had $2,789,379 that we had in expenditures. So we were only bringing in $1,692,000. We had $2,700,000 going out. Well, what was happened in that biennium was we used our savings. So we have been really frugal with the money that's come in. We've been very conscious on our spending. And in the last biennium, the legislature and legislative fiscal staff had asked us to use those savings in that biennium. So those have been used now. And so in this biennium, the assessment goes up to the $2,724,000. So there's an increase in assessments. But going back to those earlier numbers of $83 and $1,679, what that equates to is approximately about $26 for small jurisdictions and about $400 for the largest jurisdictions out there. So again, it's spread out pretty thin, that increase in assessment.
Co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. Talk to the committee about your billing cycle. Do you bill one time a year everyone, or do you have a monthly billing cycle? How does Granite versus Portland pay?
Co-chair Smith, we actually, we contract with the Department of Administrative Services that they do our invoices, but it is done once a year. So we split the biennial assessment in half, and it's done once a year. Those assessments usually go out about October, and so that's why you'll see in this budget we're looking for about a 6 month ending balance in there, because we need to be able to operate from July 1st until those assessments come in. And so that's when the billing goes out in each year. And of course, the folks that don't pay the first time, then they'll get another letter from the Department of Administrative Services. Now, as far as the state of Oregon goes, we're in the price list like any other assessment agency out there, the governor's office or anybody else that assesses state agencies. And so they also have the option of paying. They can pay monthly, quarterly, or they can pay it all in one.
That's perfect. And colleagues, the reason I was asking that question is I was trying to get at what is that that ending fund balance that you're carrying in 6 months is right in line with, I would assume, right in line where you would want them.
And that is what we tried to get it down to. Like I said, when we used up the savings that we had accumulated over those other biennia to keep the assessment down in 15-17, even though the expenditures were well above that, we brought it down to that 6 month level. So, and that's where we'll always aim to keep it at. So, sorry, moving forward here. So again, I talked a little bit about education and training, but I want to go a little bit more in depth. Like I say here, it's the highest priority for the agency. I'm a firm believer in getting out in front of the problems before they come to the commission. I know the commission has also talked about using education, and in the wisdom of the legislature back in 2007, when the big changes happened to the ethics laws, we used to just have to fine people money. And so they actually added a category for education. And so we have letters of education that we send people out. And as you'll see, a lot of times, especially with executive sessions, that little portion of the public meetings law that we have, the commission will actually not only send out letters of education, but have that group actually attend or have our folks come out and train them in executive sessions so that they do it correctly. Because it's really important that those topics that aren't supposed to be discussed in executive session are out in public. So people think that this job of training is easy, and it is, to the fact that there's about 200,000 public officials out there. The problem is the actual public officials change all the time. We don't get a lot more public officials out there positions, but the people keep changing all the time, as we see in this committee here. So we're always trying to catch up with folks and trying to, you know, new people get elected into positions. They go on to planning commissions. They go on to city councils. The state of Oregon, I would be willing to bet, is hiring somebody as we're speaking here today and making sure that those people are trained so that they know now they become a public official and there are some obligations of being a public official when it comes to the declarations of conflicts of interest, the prohibition to use your position for financial gain, and of course the gift limitations that are out there. So currently we use two trainers, and then the legislature in the last session gave us a compliance specialist three, which she also spends, I put down 0.4, but approximately half of her time in doing the trainings. And that also includes writing opinions and answering questions for people, because every day people are calling our office asking us questions about how do the ethics laws affect me in this situation. So in-person trainings are conducted statewide, with over 2,400 trained in the last year. We've also, each year we keep kind of graduating up to more, using more and more technology. At the beginning, we had iLearn modules that were out there that people could go ahead and log on to the state's website and take. Now we're actually able to conduct webinars, so somebody can actually be at their computer, they can see our trainer. Our trainer can see them if they have a camera there, and they can have interaction with the trainer, so they can ask questions as we go along, and they can keep the pace at the pace that they want to have in that training. And that saved us money for staying in the office, saves them money being able to stay at their computer, and it's been really effective for us. What I'd like to see in the next biennium is this agency look at a smart board of some sort where we can get multiple jurisdictions and multiple people in on those trainings. The other benefit to that is, as you saw here recently, we had all the snow coming on. We had some problems with the commissioners being able to make it into the office, and people being able to come to the commission and actually talk to the commission about their cases. And so that smart board would also allow them to Skype in or to FaceTime in and be able to actually see and interact with the commission and not have to drive to Salem to do that. So that's kind of my next step that we're looking at.
And co-chairs, I want to emphasize that I will still drive to Salem to participate in the meetings despite that technology enhancement. I'd rather be in the room with folks and get to look everybody in the eye and interact with them personally. Mm-hmm. So I think next we're talking about investigations. This is an area that has really changed just in the 2 years that I've been on the commission. Senator Johnson, welcome. I'm Dan Golden, Chair of Governmental Ethics Commission. Thank you. And Ron Burson, Administrator. The investigative program is complaint-driven. We receive complaints from folks all over Oregon, maybe 100, 120 a year that we actually proceed with. It's kind of a two-track process. And timelines have been shortened up considerably on that kind of preliminary area. We have a 30-day window from the time we have a complaint come in to review in a preliminary investigation and present to the commission for its determination to either go forward or dismiss. And that 30-day window is a pretty difficult window when you consider, you know, the amount of investigative information that we may have to encounter interviewing both complainant and those affected by the complaint. Also, when it involves public agencies, you know, the records, all kinds of things that may need to be looked at or possibly even subpoenaed later on. We have two basic investigative positions and a half-time person working with those folks to accomplish all that. You know, and during that 30 days, of course, while those folks are processing those initial complaints to get us to that first 30-day threshold, they're also working on the investigations that we've gone ahead and accepted from preliminary review and determined need to be investigated within the larger framework, which is a statutory deadline of up to 180 days. At the end of the investigation, investigative reports are produced by staff, and they're anywhere from 5 to 15, 20 pages, depending on the subject matter. They're reviewed by the commission, and we go ahead and sign off on a variety of different settlements, different things that that are used to finally end that case.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm curious on these investigations. I imagine some are relatively simple and others can be quite complex. Talk about how complex cases impact your cash flow. Are there times where it requires additional personnel, additional research, investigators, or is it all based upon some citizen sending in a complaint?
Co-Chair Smith, what I'll say to that is in 2015-17, I asked you for another position because, as you know, we had an investigation or a complaint that came to us with a leader in the state of Oregon, and quite frankly, we were outgunned with the level of that investigation, and so I asked for a higher level investigator to come in. So as far as cash goes, that was part of the increase in the budget, was just to kind of take on those very complex cases. Now, your picture of easy ones or less complicated to more complicated, even some of the ones that I would call fairly simple, the process itself, and I think that's what the chair was trying to talk about, the process itself requires us to go through several steps anyway. So there's not one that we can just kind of say, okay, that's an easy one, we can just bring it to the commission tomorrow and it'll be done, because we have to kind of dot all our I's and cross all our T's.
I imagine there's cases out there where you have to go out and interview or visit with folks. I guess what I'm trying to get, I'm assuming there's cases that cost more money to manage than others. Or am I wrong on that?
Co-Chair Smith, I don't think that you're wrong on that. I will say that I have been able to get those folks to come to us in the majority of the cases. So our investigators are not traveling as much as you might think. Most of the investigations are done in-house. I will say where the cost can get out of control very quickly is with the Department of Justice. But you might remember that several biennia ago, I was able to negotiate a program with the Department of Justice where we get a flat rate. And so this agency was notorious for coming back to Ways and Means for more money because of the use of attorney time. And so that was never comfortable with me. So we've negotiated a flat rate. So basically we're assessed on kind of what we used in the prior biennia. They predict what we're going to use this time. So being able to keep those costs down, again, those are some of the cost savings that we have done. But yes, there's times subpoenas will cost us a little bit more money to do. And I will say that our longtime staff at the Department of Justice was able to retire this year, and she had been with us since 1993. So we do have a new attorney, and so I'm assuming we're going to spend a little bit more time getting them up to speed on the ethics laws. So we're probably spending a little bit more time with this attorney than we did with the prior one, because she had more historical knowledge of the agency than anybody at the agency. So,
and co-chairs, Representative Smith, one of my concerns, and just speaking strictly for myself, is with the 30-day time limitation that we're currently looking at in the initial preliminary phase. I've got to tell you, I think if there's a batch of complaints that come in, and that 30-day window is looming, that 2.4 FTE that we're devoting to this process, are going to heavily tilt to get as much investigative work done as possible just in that preliminary phase. Meanwhile, they've got other serious and voluminous investigations they're right in the middle of. So I'm quite concerned about that, and I'm going to, continue to kind of track that process. I hope that we're able to meet the challenge of the caseload, based on the current levels, but for me, it's an issue.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Tangential to the question that you just raised is one that I have posed to other agencies where they are complaint driven. In some instances, particularly in the land use arena and with the Division of State Lands, I'm aware of the fact that neighbor-to-neighbor disputes sometimes give rise to using the agency as a blunt instrument to settle across-the-fence disputes. And I wonder what mechanisms you have in place to get a first cut at whether a complaint is actually valid versus political retaliation or versus some spurious claim of malfeasance. Talk a little bit about how you shepherd and husband resources rather than going after every phone call wherein some alleged malfeasance exists.
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, I'm really glad that you asked that question because on one of our slides, anyway, it shows that it looks like the number of complaints has actually dropped. But it's really like how we count them. And in the past, we've pretty much counted basically anybody that complained into the agency on how many complaints we received. But I never felt comfortable with that. And so now we're looking at the number of preliminary reviews we actually open. So to answer your question, when a complaint comes in, it isn't a giant hurdle by any means. I don't want to give that impression. But there has to be a reasonable belief that there has been a violation of the ethics laws. I'll give you an example. I got a complaint yesterday that talked about I saw a school board member drinking beer at the football game. Well, this agency does not take care of that. That's a school district policy. We are not going to get in the middle of that squabble and basically a squabble between school board members. One took the kid off the football team. So there's a fight going on, and that happens a lot of times.
You're making my point.
So we try to stay out of those things. But the first thing is it has to get past me. And if it's a signed complaint, it has to get past me as the executive director. I've been with the agency since 2006, and I feel like I have a lot of experience. Now, if it's not a written complaint, but it's an own motion that goes to the commission, it has to become a vote of the 9 members. So at least 5 of the members have to vote that forward. So there's that process. And those folks are invited in to tell the commission why they shouldn't open that complaint. So I don't want to give the impression that's a giant hurdle, but there has to be that reasonable belief that there's been a violation of our laws. And as long as there's that reasonable belief, I will have us do at least that cursory overview in preliminary review to see if that has happened. But we get a lot of complaints from folks that, you know, the judge didn't treat me right, bad management of money, things like that. And we simply do not take care of all of those.
Thank you for that very comprehensive answer, not just for the edification of the committee, but also people are listening to this being broadcast in various parts of the state. And I think it's important to have the general public understand the function of the Ethics Commission. The other thing that I would ask, and maybe you covered this, and I apologize for being out. I was over at LFO for a second. Did you comment on the proportion of inquiries in your office that are state-driven versus local government-driven? Because at one time, it's my recollection that many more were local government than were state, but I don't know if that's still the case.
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, that's my next slide.
Oh.
But I just have just a quick comment on this slide, if the chair will. One thing I want to talk about investigations is very exciting for us is, and you saw that when Wally Rogers had talked earlier, is one of the projects that is being, it was listed was our project for a case management system. And so our complaints, this investigative process is going to go away from paper and online. And so the final dispositions that the commission puts out will be online for folks. If people have public records requests they want from our cases, it's no more I'm standing at the copy machine for hours, not me personally, but trying to get those copies done. Now we'll be able to like download those from our system. And so the efficiencies in our system with case management is going to come about. Plus, our people are not keeping track of the records in files. It's going to be online for us to have. So we'll digitize those, and people can complain online. So, and they can download all of their digital information. So we're pretty excited about that. We were afforded that in the last session. Now, going on to Senator Johnson's questions, I think, you know, it's funny to me, it changes a little bit each year, but the It seems like every time I come in to testify, it seems like the percentages stay pretty close. You'll see that bottom number there. I think this answers your question, Senator Johnson, is the state accounts for about 13% of the complaints that come in. So that means 87% are with cities, counties, special districts, education, and other that's out there. So the majority of the work, and that was the original argument for the assessment, was is the majority of the work is done outside of the state of Oregon. The other thing that the case management system does, it's going to keep track of the advice that we give out. And so we should be able to have numbers for you next biennium showing not only just the complaints that come in, but where is the request for advice coming from also? Is it coming from cities, counties, the state, any other jurisdictions out there? So, and those will be posted online. So if you ever have any questions of us, you might look at the online to see maybe we've already answered that question before. So hopefully cut down on a few of the phone calls. And as Dan, Chair Golden had said earlier, I have a small staff, but we actually answer the phone. So, but if
you
we can,
do.
But if we can reduce those phone calls a little bit, that doesn't hurt anything either. So, the up above thing talks about the different categories that the commission looks at. Ethics is still 69%. The executive session's actually dropped down, and I think that's because we pointed a lot of education towards executive session. Because whenever there's an executive session complaint, it's always the whole group that's involved in that, so it's going to be 5 to 7 members. So it gets kind of a big complaint. So we've actually done a lot of education trying to get people to do executive sessions correctly. In the last 2015 session, we were also given the ability to write administrative rule on executive session, and I think some of those rules have made the laws clear to folks in helping with that education again.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So, Director, do you have any thoughts on the fact that the state of Oregon is paying half of the assessment, but only utilizing 13%.
Mm-hmm.
In these times of budget constraints, would it make sense for this committee to consider asking you folks to have cities, counties, education, special districts, other, perhaps pick up a greater share?
I just took a second there. I'm sorry, but co-chairs, Co-Chair Smith. What I will say is that the commission itself, before 2007 and the rewrites in 2009, we were a general fund agency, and we struggled for funding for the agency. And this was an agency when I came in 2006 that had 2 employees and a $600,000 biennial budget. And quite frankly, the work just was not, we weren't able to get that done. And so when the 50-50 split came about in 2007 that was instigated in 2009, we were very appreciative of that. And I will tell you that I believe the system as it is works very well. And when I talked about the compliance rate, I mean, we do not have a collection mechanism for folks that don't pay. So I work very hard to try to give those people value for their money. So when that bill comes from the Department of Administrative Services that says you owe $1,679 for this next biennium, that check is simply written and sent in. And so that over 99% compliance rate, I feel that raising it up, it could lower that. There may have to be a mechanism for collection. And so I enjoy the relationship we have with local governments. And again, what I said was is over the years, it's been pretty consistent. But that doesn't mean that it will always be consistent either. And being the only agency that gets that local funding, I feel very privileged to get it. And so, you know, you folks, I was told a long time ago, you folks are the policymakers, and I'm happy to follow any policy you create. But that's my thoughts on your question.
And co-chairs and Representative Smith, you know, if you just think about for a minute the layout that we're talking about here, special districts, you know, new folks every year, city, you know, municipalities, I mean, gosh, you got everything from big ones to little ones to
cemetery
tiny ones.
District,
yeah, I mean, all kinds, irrigation districts, I mean, you name it. And, You know, the state of Oregon, I mean, we have some pretty consistent agencies, fairly well-trained personnel, homogeneous, I guess, in a theoretical sense in terms of training and consistent employment. But at another level, I think it's really in the interest of the state of Oregon to promote this level of education and kind of preventative education out there to make sure that the taxpaying public across the board is getting the best bang for their buck and the legitimacy of government at every level is being upheld. So I think it is incumbent upon the state of Oregon to at least partner to a very large degree with all of these smaller entities.
That is not an ask. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay.
By way of institutional history, I also recall this debate early on, rancorous, people quitting boards and commissions, fighting every sentence on the report, announcing they were going to not participate in community stuff that required SEIs, and the list went on and on.
Representative Marsh.
So there are 1,700, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, there are 1,700 jurisdictions that are submitting to you, with an average of 5 to 7 people per jurisdiction?
Co-Chair, Representative Marsh, the jurisdictions can vary quite a bit.
Okay.
The 1,700 could be the city of Portland, which has over 5,000 employees. It could be a cemetery district that has one employee.
So how many statements of economic interest do you receive in a year?
Co-chairs, Representative Marsh, we receive approximately 6,000. The number changes a little bit. Like this year, there's a few bills that add a few more people that are statement of economic interest filers.
Follow-up? So how much time with your pretty small staff do you have to actually even look at 6,000 forms that come in?
Again, chairs, Representative Marsh, that was really the problem before the electronic filing system was, is we mm-hmm. were spending our whole time essentially mailing out and opening mail and essentially putting it in the file cabinet and not looking at it. What the filing system has actually allowed us to do is first of all, we have put things into the filing system that you can't file if you didn't put that in there. An example was we seem to, under the old system, we would have, it seemed like judges did this a lot. I don't mean to pick on judges today, but I guess it's only one time I said it, but they would not put anything in sources of income, but we knew they had a source of income because they were a judge, and we would call them up and say, but you know I'm a judge. You sent it to me as a judge. It's like, yes, but you have to list your sources of income. So we would spend time sending it back to them and getting it back. Now the new system requires that be filled in. Otherwise, when you go to file it, the little red line comes up that says you need to put mm-hmm. something in there. So the system does some of that work for us to make sure that the filings are complete. And what we have done, instead of spending time mailing and opening mail and putting it into file cabinets and getting it out of file cabinets for public records requests, is trying to look at the accuracy of those filings. And the commission itself is just starting now to kind of dive into that and also work the folks that we have not received a statement of economic interest.
Follow up. It does seem like it is probably logistically impossible or certainly very difficult to look to essentially look at 6,000 applications and check them off as being valid, making sense, raising no questions. I mean, and that's the core of our information other than complaints. That's really what we have to go on to see if there's compliance.
Co-chairs, Representative Marsh, I just want to be clear that for years it was thought that the statements of economic interest were for the commission, but the statements of economic interest are actually for the public in those jurisdictions. So if your city council is going to put in a new bypass, somebody can look to see, does somebody on the city council have a conflict because they own that land that bypass is going on? And so by putting it online now, we're offering it out to the public more than we used to. So the value in the statements of economic interest isn't necessarily always to the agency itself. It's really to the public out there. And our system now does come back to us and say, these were all the people that were supposed to file because now they're in electronically. And did everybody file? And so we are able to kind of chase those down and make sure that they file correctly. But as far as the process for, say, filings that may be less than accurate, you're right. We can't audit 6,000. But the public that are looking at those mm-hmm. are auditing those because we get calls all the time that says, they didn't list this rental down. They didn't list this. And so we follow up with that with our complaints. But, yes, with a staff of 9, I really don't have the ability to go through 6,000. But I will tell you the system seems to be working better underneath this electronic system than it used to.
Oh, I can't imagine 6,000 pieces of paper in a file.
So question. I'll try to stay on time here. So administration is essentially what I try to do. Again, it's managing that the money's coming in, managing the money's going out, the manager of the agency, all the support functions that are out there, and, of course, representing the agency and legislation, this budget, media, which sometimes can be a full-time job, and any special projects that are out there. So cost containment, I've talked a lot about how this agency has saved money over the years, and these are some of the things that we've done. First of all, we've talked a lot about the electronic filing system, saving us some money on postage and printing and things like that. But that really wasn't a cost-saving measure that came out. It was really more of a transparency measure that came out because those same people that I was sitting there before using them to open mail and file paper, now they are looking at just what Representative Marsh asked for. Does the statements of economic interest and the lobby and client reports, do they look correct? And so that's where those funds are going. The commission meetings now are digitally recorded, so we got a lot of requests for, we used to do it on cassette tape. Now people can actually post them on our website, so there doesn't need to be a public records request from us, and there's no cost to the public to get that. I talked about us doing webinars now. We purchased a webcam and the software to be able to do that online. It's been a big benefit to the state and or to our agency and to the folks taking that training. You also see on our, if you go to our website, and I'm sure that you will for your statement of economic interest, you'll see that there's actually tutorials on there. There's YouTube tutorials that you can look at. And if you have any questions, sometimes that'll answer quite a few of your questions for you. So we're using those kind of videos and that are planted onto our website. And speaking of our website is also due to be upgraded. So we think in this next biennium, we're going to be able to even use the website for more because we're part of that transition to the new state website. So we're excited about that. We continue to consolidate our expenses. We live with 7 other agencies out in the Morrow Crane Building. It's a private building, but Mr. Morrow has taken it upon himself to charge us a little bit less per square foot, so that because he likes to have state agencies be renters out there, and so but it allows us small agencies to consolidate printing and shuttle costs and boardroom costs and just all those little costs that go along with telephone. Our data lines can all be shared between these other agencies. So a couple of the performance measures I really wanted to talk about. First of all, underneath customer service, you might have looked in my budget report, and you'll notice that 2 years ago, we had quite a dip in customer service. Went clear down like in the 50s. But you might remember there was a very public issue that came up that involved the Ethics Commission 2 years ago. And somehow, we got kind of equated with that our helpfulness and timeliness and just demeanor, I guess, was kind of went down with that. But I'm happy to say that in this next biennium, it's come up. It hasn't met our goals. But we work very hard to do all of those things that are in that customer service survey, like say to be timely, to answer those telephones, to get back to people that are asking us questions. We give them a written response on email or a letter so that they can have something in their hands that they've asked the Ethics Commission if this is within the law. And so it's ticked back up, but I just wanted to talk about that anomaly and that we've moved forward with that. I was going to have the chair talk just real quick about best practices with my review of the committee chair.
Right. Co-chairs, policy package 90, reclassification of the executive director's position from principal executive manager D to principal executive manager E. This is long overdue. Commission has repeatedly, before my time, requested that that this position be examined for reclassification. Asked many years ago that process be begun. Commission was put off 3 years ago when DAS requested that the commission hold its request until the Oregon Management Project Review is complete, and then that was postponed, and finally we re-requested that that the review be done under the Hays system, and that's finally been completed. There's a recommendation to reclassify the executive director to principal executive manager E. And when you kind of look at the changes that the commission's undergone for all these many years while we've been requesting this reclassification, my goodness, we've gone in commissioners from 7 to 9, increase in employees at the commission from 2 to 8, budget increase from $600,000 to over $2.5 million now. We're talking about data system development and management and the statutory changes to the timelines that we've described and our concerns about that. But just on a more personal note, I have to say I've been on the commission for 2 years, and I've rarely experienced a more welcoming and professional environment that is being maintained at the commission office. This is a first-rate agency. It's being managed very effectively and very frugally when you look at the whole layout of all of its responsibilities. And the helpfulness to the public, you know, our educational mission, trying to correct misperceptions or apprehensions that people have when they enter into this process. We're struggling, you know, with that data system. The professionalism of staff and the courtesy that occurs not only, you know, to the public in terms of just customer relations, but also around the table that we as commissioners, when we have our meetings, there has never been a partisan struggle or an unprofessional struggle or anything of that nature in that commission. We are focused on the mission and the statutory obligations that we have to uphold those ethical standards and ethics laws around the state of Oregon. And we try to motivate the public out there to accomplish that. And a lot of that has to do with the tone of professionalism that has been imparted to all of us and to staff by the executive director. So I think this reclassification is long overdue. I think it's reflected in the professionalism of the operation. And so I want to heartily encourage the committee to go forward with that piece of the budget.
So going back real quick, under best practices, one thing I just wanted to mention on that is that the commission does do a 360 review of me every year. The public and yourselves, everybody that all our stakeholders are invited to that. There's an email that goes out so people can actually opine on the job that I've done over the past years or give the commission. And all those comments are given to the commission.
Well, what is your rating from the comments?
You know, I've actually done pretty well, co-chair. I will say that there's been even the folks that we have I don't want to say tussled, but maybe disagreed with in our stakeholders in different directions we've gone. I think that there's a level of respect out there for the agency and for the work that I do. And of course, the commission itself, the commissioners rate me on a scale of 1 to 5. And I think this last year I averaged about 4.7 or something on all those different categories in the rankings. I look back to one of our former commissioners, Larry Campbell, and he had the idea that nobody gets a 5 all the time. So you got to always have something to strive for. So I think the commission always gives me something to strive for and something to work on the next year. So I appreciate that from them. So budget drivers, the big drivers for this agency, again, are the systems that are out there. I want to be clear that when these systems were created, I guess I should say the e-government, but I would probably be the ones that come up here and say NICUSA, because they're the ones that are actually doing the work on the ground for us. This is a subscription model. We paid no development costs for either one of these two systems. That's where an agency can really get out of hand with the development costs. And so we've agreed to that. The subscription business and the subscription, it's also a maintenance fee that's out there. And like Wally had said, I was very proud that the electronic filing system did win that nationwide award. I never travel on the state, but I asked the commission if I could travel back to get that award, so I did do that. So I went to the city of Baltimore, and like I say, it was a great time. It was great to see Oregon represented in that nationwide search, since especially for our IT project. I was very proud of that. So those are the big drivers that are in there right now. The case management system, we've met our statutory deadline. We are now posting all of our final dispositions and advice online. We are now building actually the tools for my investigators to get through their cases more efficiently, and for the public to be able to see those with a public records request. The agency will continue to focus its resources towards training the public officials, lobbyists, entities that hire lobbyists, and the public about the laws, EFS, and I shouldn't use acronyms, electronic filing system, and the case management system.
Ron, let me ask you a question, please.
Sure.
You mentioned the public records requests. Currently, what is just estimate volume of requests do you get, and are you going to be going to a more electronic format in order to increase turnabout or response time, or is the current response system adequate?
Co-Chair Manning, I really appreciate you asking that question, because I've worked really hard at this agency so that the people don't have to make public records requests to me. That, like I said, our meeting minutes are now posted online in digital format. You can download them and listen to them whenever you want. We try to, before even the electronic system, we were scanning statements of economic interest that we knew people would ask for, such as all of your folks' statements of economic interest. Every year we were asked for the legislators, so the 90 members was in one nice little scanned pile. So when it was asked for by the Oregonian or some other public entity out there, we could just send that to them at no cost, so they got it right away. So the electronic system, what it's going to do is they're not going to need to even call me anymore. Mm-hmm. If they want to look at your statement of economic interest, or the other day I testified down in room 50 and they wanted a demonstration of electronic filing system, I used my own statement of economic interest, because I think it's the only time it's ever been shown to anybody. So I wanted somebody to be able to see the thing. But people are able to go onto our system under the public records and just look at those now. And so I try to prevent people from even having to use our agency. The reason I mentioned that was, in the case management system, what the legislature required in that statute was that we are required to post the final dispositions of cases and our advice online. But as you know, the chair had talked about that these investigators are doing a lot of work, and so they're building on a file, and now they're going to build that electronic file. If somebody asks me for those records during the time they're building that file, I have Currently, with the paper system, I have to go out and make those copies and get that to them. Now, underneath this new system, if they request that on a public record, I will have those records already digitized, and they'll get them right away. So the speed is going to be faster, and the cost is going to be nominal, if anything at all. So because we'll already have the records scanned in into our system, and so it shouldn't really cost us any money. They're not going to be copying costs and postage and printing costs that are charged. So you'll look at our budget. We have a few things that are general fund. One is fines. The other one is some of these other income sources that we get, and one was from public records requests, and you'll have seen that kind of dive down. It's never been a lot of money. It's been about $3,000 in a biennium, but it's actually going down because people aren't having to ask us for the record requests, and when they do, I'm able to provide that record at no cost to them, and it's provided right away.
So what about thank you for that. What about personal information, personal data on there? So when you're downloading and putting this all this information online, what measures are you using to ensure privacy matters when it comes to personal information?
Yes, Chair Manning, I appreciate the question. In this new system, there will be a redaction tool that's in there, so that we're able to use that tool to redact any kind of information that's not public record, personal addresses, phone numbers, if there's a bank account or something that's in there, that wouldn't be done. So we would basically use that tool to redact that. So it is going to take there may be some time with our folks to be able to use that, but it's going to be much faster than it was with me just simply, doing it one at a time and taking that black marker. We've all seen the public records with the black marks across them. So so we have thought about that in this case management system, and there is a plan to have a redaction tool.
Thank you.
Co-chair?
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. I'm going to go back to performance measures really quick. How often does the commission receive inquiries from the legislature on ways to enhance Oregon's ethic laws? Do you ever get inquiries from us saying how to make it better?
Co-chair Smith, I have not, sir.
I thought so. Yeah, it's interesting because you hear about it in the paper, but never once has this body ever sent you folks a formal letter saying, hey, how would you make this better?
I will say that I've had a lot of discussions with people in the legislative body, and I think out of those discussions, there's been a lot of ideas that come about, especially early on when I took over this agency. Uh-huh. I came from another agency. I was a director of another agency and came to it, and I remember Representative Berger having lots of discussions with her. Senator Johnson, I know I've had discussions with her, yourself, right, about ways to improve it. And I think we've taken a lot of that in, but we would always welcome any kind of, help from the policymakers. I mean, I enjoy that. I think that the more people thinking about ways to improve us, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you. I didn't mean to digress on that. I was just curious.
No, that's a great answer. Question, Senator Johnson.
I'm glad to hear that response. I knew that's what you were going to say, but I'm glad to hear it on the record. I think that in our efforts to make some of our ethics processes in the state of Oregon more transparent, we've made a bit of a muddle out of it. And people that want to follow the rules are occasionally confounded in doing so, particularly when we've gotten in the area of legislators appearing at events, comestibles and libations, honoraria. We've gotten it, I think, unnecessarily complicated in an effort to look like there's a crackdown on evildoers and malfeasers in this building. So any thoughts that you would have as the people adjudicating these questions, I think, would be welcome back to us. The good news is that we dug some of this hole. We can undig it, too. And people are listening, and this is not Johnson wants to relax ethics rules. It's just I want to make them easier to follow and more explicable both to the participants, the lobby legislators, but also to Oregonians, so that they know what the gold standard of good ethical behavior is, and they know that your agency is holding public servants accountable to it.
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, I appreciate that comment, and I will tell you that I think a step in the right direction is this case management system. And I know I've focused on the investigative tools, but that advice is really going to be helpful for folks, because I know, especially at the end of session, people are invited, such as yourselves, to different events. I know that your districts want to celebrate your accomplishments during the session. They invite you out for different things. And I know we get a lot of questions about those different events, and that will be posted online, not only for folks to be able to see that we've already opined on that, but for the public to be able to see that yes, we allow a legislator to go to a meeting and discuss legislation, discuss their job with their constituents, and oh, by the way, there might be some food and drink at there, that it isn't prohibited that they actually have some of the food or have some water or something there. So I think that's going to help. But each session, I think the commission itself, through the governor's office, puts through some bills that I think help out. I know in the last session, one of the gift exceptions that allowed you to go out and accept food and beverage and admission to an event, it didn't include relatives in there, and so I know there was legislators that had
your wife stood in the corner while you had a glass of wine.
it allowed your spouse or a household member, but it didn't allow, like, if you want to take your grandchild or a child that was living outside your home, it didn't allow them. So we added relative to it so that we weren't having to tell people no, you weren't able to take your grown child to an event where they were going to celebrate your accomplishments.
Well, and that we follow, and that kind of murky area, let's assume somebody represents a winery, and at Christmas comes, and you're friends with the owner, and at Christmas comes the box of wine, and you're put in the embarrassing position of calling up and saying, gee, I really appreciated the two bottles of wine. You didn't go over $50, did you? I mean, that's, and when does that line between a friend giving a friend a couple of bottles of wine and a friend that may have legislative interests giving a legislature a gift, it begins to get sort of complicated, but it's awkward to have to call somebody up and say, how much was that bottle of wine? We don't want to get anybody in trouble here. So it's complicated, and I think everybody wants to make sure that we keep Oregon the kind of squeaky clean place that we envision it to be, although that seems to be getting harder and harder all the time. And you're really the steward of doing that. So anything that you can do to make it easier for people to follow the rules, I think, is welcome.
Thank you. Okay. So the last thing we talked about, or I'd like to talk about today, and so we leave our people with a little bit of time here, is the other policy package that this agency is bringing forth is another reclassification of our program analyst position to an operations and policy analyst too. Quite frankly, this was a position in the agency where it just didn't feel like the position description really fit what the position was doing. So I sat down and rewrote that position to really reflect what the position did. And then I stayed out of this, and I sent it over to DAS HR, their class and comp, and asked them, tell me what this is. Originally, I thought, okay, well, maybe it's a two. But they came back and says, no, it's not even in the program analyst series. And so they moved it to the operations and policy analyst too. This is an $8,100 lift for the agency. But I will tell you that this position over the last several biennia has just increased in the amount of duties. And that's really what drove this is I talked about the system. And I talked about the paper filings before. This was a position that made sure those paper filings came in timely and were filed timely and stuff. And now it's much more than that. Whenever there's a little hitch in the system, you might have saw, a few weeks ago, you might have heard from some lobbyists. But the notice part of our system said, uh-oh, we have a problem. And they actually sent out a notice that says you haven't filed your lobbyist report when they actually had filed. And then it wanted to send another one that says, oh, by the way, if you don't file, you're going to get a penalty. So that obviously caused a lot of headache for us, a lot of phone calls coming in. And this is really the point person on there working with the vendor, and they got that solved within a day. So their responsibility levels have just risen up dramatically with the onset of these electronic systems. So I support this reclassification for that position.
I would just add, by way of a bit of a bouquet toss, that this agency far exceeds any others in terms of responsiveness. Right. You can actually call and get Mr. Burson on the phone. I agree with the characterization of this as a customer-friendly organization, even though they're in the regulatory business. The fact that he gets any kind of a positive response on customer service, I mean, this is the sheriff in Dodge, and it's really remarkable. And I fully support the policy option packages that help provide some additional support for the two important positions. I really think this is an extraordinarily responsive agency, and Mr. Burson has done a good job. It did not always enjoy a good reputation. I think it certainly under your leadership does. So for the co-chair's consideration, I think they do a bang-up job.
Great. We're closing in on time, so.
I'm sorry, co-chair. The last slide I have, I included this in the last biennium. My legislative fiscal officer, John Borden, thought it was a good idea, but this basically just kind of gives you folks an idea of the jobs we do, and as you move along that continuum, the more expensive it gets. So my job is to try to keep things down toward the left-hand side of this continuum. And try to keep it from progressing forward. But you can kind of see that as we go further down that continuum, it gets more expensive. Clear up to attorney general opinions. Mm-hmm. I will say that attorney general opinions are the most expensive. The opinions that my commission gives out, the advisory opinions, they are free to the requester of those opinions. So if people have, if they have a question about the ethics laws, they should ask us first before they spend a lot of money at the Attorney General's office, because we will answer that question for them at no cost. So anyway, that's the end of my co-chair. Happy to answer.
Well, I want to kind of add to that and echo Senator Johnson as well. In my 9 terms, several times I've had the need to contact your agency just to seek counsel. And I'll tell you what, that's extraordinarily valuable to get on the front end of an issue. Yeah. And to get that advice, get that counsel, get your parameters ironed out. So that way when questions do come up, you've got a formal letter that says, this is what you asked, here's our response back. And I would compliment you folks, you've always been responsive. And in my 9 terms, I've never once, I was trying to think, and I was texting my office, I've never once had any issue in my 3 different districts that I've served in 18 years. I think it says a lot for what you folks are doing.
I appreciate the comments. Thank you.
Representative Marsh, followed by Representative Nierman.
Yeah, I'm going to fall on the line of kudos. I'm new to this body, but I've been filling these forms out for probably 10 years as a local elected official, and I am so happy that you've gone to an electronic system. Because it will make our lives much easier. And just sitting here, I looked myself up, and then I looked up a bunch of you, and you're all in here, I can tell you. and that's a great service to the public. So what a step forward that really is.
Thank you.
Representative Ehrman?
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good. And I have a little bit of a different take on this as a customer from a different perspective. And I had a what I consider a politically motivated complaint filed against me. And I from that perspective, I appreciate the professionalism of your office there. And I would have rather not have had to go through that. The complaint included my failure to file my 7 sheep on my SEI. They don't earn me more than $10,000 a year of income there. I'm down to 6 sheep now because I ate one of them. But anyway, I appreciate your agency's professionalism on that. And I want to highlight something that you brought up earlier there. One of the other things was that The instructions said that I needed to provide all of my sources of income, and then it said, for a list of possible sources of income, turn to page 2, and on page 2, it listed possible sources of income. This is back in the printed form days. And the list was, it said wages or dividends or royalties, or it was a list that looked like that there. So I took off that list, and I put as a source of income wages. And not knowing that you wanted to know the company that I worked for. So anyway, so I thought I was doing it right. But the remedy for that was as painless as possible. So that was an innocent mistake on my part. But just a letter of education and to go and correct it. And so that was a humane and a happy ending to what was kind of a ugly attack on me, and like Senator Johnson said, just using the agency as kind of a blunt tool. But I appreciate your professionalism, and I don't think it could have been handled any better by your agency, so thank you.
I appreciate that.
We have like 2 minutes left. I think Mr. Arturo, you're going to do a brief. I don't think that you're going to get a chance to get through it in 3 minutes time or 2 minutes time. So can we have you back on Monday at the top of the show?
Co-chair Manning, I only have 5 slides, so I could plow through it if you'd like.
Okay. Well, I want to be considerate of the committee members that may have other committee assignments that they have to get through, and I don't want to hold them back.
So Mr. Kutcher, okay? I have capital construction right now, but I fully trust your ability as we go through this.
Okay.
So. Okay.
Rock and roll. Any other committee members have an obligation that you had to leave right now, then please excuse yourself. Thank you.
Okay, Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, and members of the committee, I'll be quick and just go through the highlights. As you already heard, the emerging issues for the agency are really revolve around the public meeting laws. This chart right here shows the expenditures of the agency. There's really no growth.
Mr. Arturo, for the records, please state your name.
Yes. For the record, my name is Robert Otero with the Chief Financial Office. So this chart shows that the agency has actually had a slight decrease in expenditures, and that was some phase out for the electronic filing system. The agency budget by expenditure category is mainly personal services, and it's split out mainly 2/3. And the governor's investments in the budget are really for the continued subscription of the case management system and the reclassification of 2 positions, and then some statewide adjustments for DAS price list and state government service charges that reduce some operations costs for the agency. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee? If no questions or from the committee, thank you, sir. That was very effective and efficient. We will adjourn the subcommittee on general government and reconvene on Monday, 1500. That's 3:00 for civilians, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.
For civilians, and we are adjourned.